Good afternoon, everyone. Can everyone hear me okay? Well, great. I'm Frank Grizzard, director of the Lee Family Digital Archive, and on behalf of the archive and the History Department at Washington and Lee and the Lee Chapel and Museum, I want to welcome you to our second installment of the Spring Speaker Series for Washington and Lee 2007. The last week we had Richard Henry Lee. This week we have Arthur Lee. And if you were here last week, you know we had Richard Henry Lee live here in person all the way from the 18th century. Well, this week we have instead not Arthur Lee, but an Arthur Lee scholar all the way from Stratford Hall. And it's my pleasure to introduce Ken McFarland. He's Director of Preservation, Education. I don't know what other hats he wears there. You might want to ask him in the question and answer period, but he's been there a number of years. And they had serious staff reductions a few years ago, and those hats became not just three corners, but many corners. For many years, he's directed and helped direct the Monticello Stratford Hall Seminar, which invites teachers from all over the country. They spend part of their time at Stratford Hall, part at Monticello. It's a very successful program. It's been in existence for 27 years. So Ken is going to speak on one of the Lees, a distant cousin of Robert E. Lee from the generation before, who at this point in time isn't very well known, but in the 18th century was very well known. The pamphleteer of the revolution is what his name was, because he wrote so many radical tracts about independence and liberty. And he wasn't very well liked by a lot of people at the time period, although, he had his admirers. So without further ado, I want to introduce Ken to you, and come on up, Ken, and let's make him welcome.
Thanks very much, Frank. I'm going to turn on my lapel mic and hope we don't get too much feedback, just in case I want to step away from wherever it is I'm being covered from. Anytime anybody refers to me as a scholar of anything, my palms begin to perspire. I'm principally my tasks at Stratford are facilitating the installation of geothermal HVAC systems and trying to organize and produce programs, and I didn't get nearly as much time as I wish I had to actually study the incredibly rich amount of material that's available to me at Stratford and, of course, at many other sources, too, relating to the Lees and those associated with the Lees. In asking that I might come here and speak, Frank gave me the choice of, well, this is the microphone. Man, I thought it was something else. That was a light. Frank gave me the option of the topic, and I actually had a presentation on Robert E. Lee and his visit to Warren County, North Carolina, shortly before he died to visit the grave of Annie Carter Lee. I wrote an architectural history of Warren County some years back and came to know that site very well. But that's a PowerPoint presentation, and thanks to Frank, you're being spared a PowerPoint presentation. As you might imagine, this is not a good setting for that, but it is a wonderful setting and a great honor to be speaking here today. And for obvious reasons, in connection to Stratford, it's a wonderful place to talk. And Lexington is, I know I don't need to tell you, certainly one of the first cities in Virginia, in my opinion. It's always just a treat to be here. And in addition, my great-great-grandfather was at the Battle of New Market. He was in the 51st Virginia, not in the Corps of Cadets. But that also resonates with me. My great-grandmother lived in the same house with me as I was growing up, and she told me lots of stories about her father, so adventures, if you will, at that battle. Well, then why am I speaking about Arthur Lee? Unlike last week's subject, I assure you that today he is thoroughly deceased and not alive in any fashion, other than, however, I might be able to breathe a little bit of life into him. But he's a favorite of mine, and so given the luxury of picking my topic, that's why I chose him. I mean, who is he? Frank's already provided a bit of information for you, but to establish a context in time, for those of you who are unfamiliar with Arthur, it's easiest to do by noting that he was the youngest of the generation of Stratford Lees that included the two signers of the Declaration of Independence, they, of course, being Richard Henry Lee and Francis Lightfoot Lee, both of whom in various ways do get, I think, at least some attention, Richard Henry through Stratford, Francis Lightfoot Lee, and now, of course, through the restoration, if you will, of the ruins at Monocan. I don't know how many of you have been to Monocan, but it's in Richmond County, not terribly far from Stratford, and close to Mount Airy and Sabin Hall, and I'd certainly recommend a visit there sometime just to see what they're doing, and part of what they're doing, of course, is drawing some attention to Francis Lightfoot. And how were they related to Robert E. Lee? Well Frank has gotten to the point just a bit. Their father, Thomas, was the son of the second Richard Lee, the son of Richard the Immigrant. And that second Richard Lee was also the father of the first Henry Lee, and who was in turn the great-grandfather of Robert E. Lee. Now, I have to apologize. I don't know how many removed cousins that is. And I heard Frank talking in the back a few minutes ago about all the relationships and everything, but I do have a copy of Lee of Virginia with me, in case somebody should ask me a question, but I'll tell you, it's one that I may have to turn to Frank if I get any questions like that. I also need to establish the fact that Arthur Lee has not been ignored. And there have been several. There was a wonderful doctoral dissertation done on him in the 1960s, and then a biography done in the 90s that do provide a lot of insight, other smaller scale publications that provide a look at his life and his career and as I say, some of the animosities that he developed. But I like to talk about him because, well, first and chiefly, there's a large body of material that survives that he wrote, and I find him a wonderful mirror that reflects the periods, places, and people, including himself, of course, crucial to the formation of this country, and in places that I find interesting, too. Again, not as well known today as the signers, Arthur Lee nonetheless played an important and fascinating role in helping to shape our national destiny during the Revolutionary era. And he also numbers among those 18th century Lees that, since we're here today, in the company of Robert E. Lee, familiar to Robert E. Lee, and whose ideas and actions could provide inspiration when the man honored here in this chapel had to make his own painful decisions about separation and revolution. Robert E. Lee certainly knew the memoirs of Arthur, the life of Arthur Lee, is published in 1829 and edited by Richard Henry Lee, who was the grandson of the original Richard Henry. I want to examine briefly three periods in Arthur Lee's life, with particular emphasis on the 8 years leading to the separation of the American colonies from Great Britain, preceded by some review of his early life and education, and closing with a short discussion of the period after 1776, which is worthy of its own separate talk, and many separate talks, actually. It's a fascinating time. But let me start with quotes from two highly famous individuals of his age. It gets to some of the point that Frank mentioned. In April 1778, in a letter never mailed, Benjamin Franklin apparently did that. It's not a bad idea, actually. You write these letters and you vent your spleen and then you don't mail them. I think that I've done that with some emails, actually. It's always really smart not to mail emails like that because you never know when they're going to come back to you. Not much, though. But in this letter never mailed, Benjamin Franklin, while the two were in France, 1778, warned Lee of the dangers of his, quote, sick mind, which is forever tormenting itself with its jealousies, suspicions, and fancies that others mean you ill, wrong you, or fail to respect you. If you do not cure yourself of this temper, it will end in insanity. So, pretty strong words, but again, I'm sure he thought about mailing it, because again, it gets to a relationship that I'll allude to further in a few minutes. By contrast, in 1819, it gets back to some of the issues that may be present in Franklin's letter too, but from another perspective.
John Adams termed Arthur Lee,
quote, a man too early in the service of his country to avoid making a multiplicity of enemies. Too honest, upright, faithful, and intrepid to be popular. Too often obliged by his principles and feelings to oppose Machiavellian intrigues to avoid the destiny he suffered.
The man never had justice done him by his country in his lifetime, and I fear he never will have by posterity.
His reward cannot be of this world.
Born in December 1740, Arthur was the last of the eight children of Thomas and Hannah Ludwell Lee, the builders of Stratford. And as much as the Stratford staff would like today to say that at least Arthur, the youngest, was born there, the timber dating has proven some while back that the signers could not have been born there. It used to be thought that. And you'll still find publications today that pick up old information and will tell you that the house was built in 1730 and that the signers, or even earlier, sometimes 1725, that the signers were born there, but they're not really checking their facts because the timber dating dendrochronology work and showed that it was begun about 1738, probably not completed until 1740 and after. Again, no light has come to support the fact, nothing has come to light to support the fact that Arthur was born there. Nearby in Westmoreland County for sure, but not at Stratford, unfortunately. But surely his earliest memories of home were of the grand brick mansion on the Potomac, where I spend a good deal of my time. And there were memories of his parents as well, but since both died before he was 10, Arthur turned early to his siblings for support and guidance. Though Philip Ludwell Lee, the oldest member of his generation and heir to Stratford, controlled the purse strings, and he did indeed control them, and without going off into that subject, that was a topic of some contention within the family for years to come, not the least of which with Arthur. It was Richard Henry Lee who became the central family figure in Arthur's life and some of his richest correspondence as to Richard Henry Lee. Like the other Lee children, and as with so many other children of the Virginia gentry, Arthur was privately tutored, being trained in the classics by one Reverend Mr. Craig, a Scottish clergyman I wish more was known. By the way, Stratford was a house full of books. These were people of books. One of the things I don't think we do very well now, but we're going to try to do, is give visitors a better sense of that. And I know sometimes we open these bookcases and they see some books that are falling apart. But it's really crucial to know that these indeed were well-read people. They founded their ideas on that. They just sometimes I think that maybe the Lees are presented as just sort of springing out of the head of somebody, head of Zeus, knowing everything, but they really were indeed people who studied, and Arthur Lee was certainly one of those who benefited from that as well. Subsequently, following in the footsteps of Philip Ludwell Lee, Arthur studied between 1752 and 1758 at Eton, then and now one of England's most prestigious schools. One of the, little aside here I'll go into, I don't know how many of you watch House. I've never actually watched a full episode of House, but I've seen snippets of House, the doctor. Any of you familiar with them talking about House? You know about House. You know about House. Well, you probably all know that the actor who plays House, Hugh Laurie, is really best known for his comedic work. He's British. And he strains very hard, I understand, to try to keep that American accent going on a regular basis throughout that show. But he's also a graduate of Eton, so when you do watch the episodes of House and you realize what his background is, remember also that he attended Eton. Little is known about Lee's time at Eton, but it can be surmised that owing to his colonial, I think it can be very safely surmised, that owing to his colonial background, he suffered painful taunts relating to the English chauvinism of his fellow students at Eton. And I think it's tempting to theorize that the pride of origin and strong patriotism regarding Virginia and America that Lee so powerfully demonstrated in coming years was boosted by his Eaton experience. Nobody can be more chauvinistic, or could be. I don't know that they're quite that bad anymore, but then the English word, particularly not only about Americans, but also about Scots and Irish and people from Wales, and certainly people from France, and there just weren't that many that fit the bill for them. Upon completion of his studies at Eton, Arthur returned to Virginia in 1759, but the following year found him back in Britain. It was the wish of his older brothers that he study medicine at Cambridge, actually. But that, however, was a wish not to be fulfilled. Staying with Ludwell family relatives in London, Arthur socialized with many well-known people of the age, including Samuel Johnson, the famous Boswell's Life of Fame. And it was Johnson, we hear, and I really would like to verify this, but who recommended that Arthur study at Edinburgh instead of Cambridge. I mean, he didn't know Samuel Johnson, so I think it's distinctly possible. He also knew James Boswell even better. It was a wise choice. As many of you probably know, Edinburgh in the 18th century was the most celebrated center of for medical education in the world. And it was at that celebrated center that Lee began his studies in early 1761. The medical faculty, moreover, was a main source of the university's reputation, and one of Lee's soon-to-be professors, William Cullen, stood at the head of the British medical profession. So he was going to the place to study in his field. At Edinburgh, we began to encounter, I'm sure it was present before he went to Edinburgh, but we certainly start to see evidence of it, a cocky self-assurance that was a theme common in Arthur Lee's life. I don't think it was unique to Arthur Lee either. I think some of the other Lees, certainly Philip Ludwell Lee, was also had cocky self-assurance. Parenthetically, I'll add that Lee himself was capable of acknowledging certain flaws in that direction. In a 1774 letter to Brother Francis Lightfoot, he confessed to shortcomings brought on by, quote, the impatience of my disposition, which fueled a certain, quote, impetuosity and improvidence. Again, I think Benjamin Franklin might have agreed with that, too. His combative personality was on display more than once while in the, sure you know, Edinburgh is oftentimes, or at least was in the 18th century, referred to as the Athens of the North, providing a foretaste of future actions and behavior. One example occurred when the young Virginian took offense at negative statements about Southern slaveholders made by the famous Adam Smith in his book A Theory of Moral Sentiments, which was published in 1759. Smith's inquiry into the nature and causes of the wealth of nations wouldn't appear until 1776, but the Scottish professor already stood in high regard in Great Britain. By the way, he was a graduate of Oxford and beyond for his wide-ranging scholarship. And indeed, in 1761, Arthur Lee had arranged a meeting in Glasgow with Smith to discuss farming techniques, and thus he knew the great Scott personally. I'm sorry about that great Scott, but isn't that what the great Gilder? Somebody used to say the great Scott. I just had to get that in. In an essay in Vindication of the Continental Colonies of America from a censure of Mr. Adam Smith in his Theory of Moral Sentiments with some reflections on slavery in general. And I'll add that Arthur Lee was not a supporter of slavery. He was opposed to slavery. He was not basing that on what he thought were natural rights possessed by enslaved Africans. Indeed, like many of his contemporaries, he thought that, in effect, Africans deserved to be enslaved. His writings would go into that sort of topic. But he thought it was, nonetheless, in general, a wrong practice. And he also, and this is important, blamed Great Britain for foisting slavery onto America. He believed it was part of a larger plot to to, in effect, enslave all Americans, and he made a strong case for that. As enslavement was used in 18th century terminology and British terminology, American terminology. While in Edinburgh, Lee was also a leading member of the Virginia Club, a small organization of students with roots in the Old Dominion. It was no mere social group, though, as the Virginia Club members were staunch and vocal advocates for the medical profession. That was evidenced by the leading role they played in actual, what has sometimes been called an uprising, in opposition to a medical faculty proposal to grant degrees to two Englishmen who had not completed proper courses of study at Edinburgh. One of those was an apothecary, and there was a great deal of concern that apothecaries were stepping beyond their bounds and trying to claim to be doctors. And thus he and several others put their future on the line, but ultimately the university backed down and reached a compromise regarding the degrees. Lee advocated for the medical profession in other ways as well, writing to the Virginia Council and Burgesses in support of licensure for doctors, while he and his brother-in-law, William Shippen Jr., discussed at length the feasibility of opening a medical school in Philadelphia. So he was really keenly involved in not simply the day-to-day affairs of study, but also in looking towards the bigger picture in relation to the medical profession and the respect that he felt it was due. So you're starting to see Arthur Lee at Edinburgh, and as you would see much more of him as time passed. He graduated from the University of Edinburgh in September of 1764, and he received the Gold Medal Prize for his essay on Peruvian bark. And I dare say some of you can tell me what Peruvian bark is. Who can tell me? This will be the only time I ask any of you anything, but what does Peruvian bark contain? Quinine, exactly. So fundamentally, he was looking towards a material that provided protection against or help in the face of malaria. We have a copy of that. It's in Latin, and I started to bring it so I could read it to you today, but unfortunately I just forgot it at the last minute, so I'll have to come back another time and read to you his essay on Peruvian bark. But it did well by Arthur. Subsequently, he began the first of what would be numerous continental journeys, touring Holland and France in the spring of 1765, and indeed received a second medical degree in Holland. The jewel of the crown, however, came in February 1766 when, through the sponsorship of, believe it or not, Benjamin Franklin, this was early days, Arthur was accepted into the Royal Society of London. Very prestigious. Here you have 1740. He was now, 25. During this period, Lee's growing scholarly reputation also led to an association with William Petty, the Earl of Shelburne, and later Marquess of Lansdowne, who was only 3 years Lee's senior. Not a radical, per se, Shelburne nonetheless numbered among those Whigs who would oppose taxation of the colonies. And he also liked to surround himself with bright people. And this was certainly the case of a number of members of the British aristocracy, not all, but a number who were Enlightenment figures and prided themselves on their ability to keep abreast of modern thinking. And these people were frequently guests at his estate, Bowood, and Arthur fit the bill perfectly for a friend of the Earl of Shelburne. An enduring friendship developed, and in the final days of his life, as again, some of you may know, he named his home Lansdowne, the place where he died, in honor of the Earl of Shelburne. Despite such pleasing associations, Arthur nonetheless returned to Virginia in the summer of 1766, where he settled in Williamsburg to practice medicine. For all that had gone on, and for all of his advocacy of the medical profession, it turned out he really didn't like it very well, and he didn't practice medicine very long in Virginia. It reminds me, I don't know how common it is for doctors to
go through all the study that's necessary and then decide they don't like the medical profession and find something else to do. I know it's not unique. But there's a term called running from the law. I know a number of people who studied law went into the practice of law and decided they didn't like it and are running bookshops. But he decided he did not like medical profession. But what he did decide and what he took to was politics and controversy. And to that end, he quickly became embroiled in the affairs of his brother Richard Henry, and with one of the most interesting stories relating to Virginia and the implementation of the Stamp Act, and this may have been brought up last week. And it grew out of the fact that while Richard Henry was to lead a powerful attack, including burning effigies, etc., on George Mercer for accepting the job of stamp agent, Lee himself had initially sought the job. So Richard Henry Lee had initially sought to be the stamp agent. And later on he explained it well. He started to look at the situation. Maybe that wasn't a good thing after all. And he was a man always in need of money. I mean, he had many children, and it was all. But in this case, he saw the light, and accusations and counter-accusations flew until April 1767, when Arthur and James Mercer, brother of the stamp distributor, agreed to meet on the field of honor near Williamsburg. As with many proposed duels, however, this one failed to happen. Apparently, Arthur showed up at the time they were supposed to duel, but they claimed James Mercer wasn't there, but James Mercer said, well, he was there. I think there were ways that not every duel ended as did the Hamilton-Burr incident. But it certainly indicates the level to which their quarrel had risen. The situation also provided Arthur with an opportunity for publication in the Virginia Gazette, and he quickly developed a taste for such work. And he was soon to step beyond the local stage, however, for in his 1768 Virginia Gazette Monitor essays, written to complement John Dickinson's farmer letters, which had appeared in the Pennsylvania Chronicle, firing a series of broadsides at recent parliamentary acts, including the Quartering Act and the Townsend Act. So he read these letters by John Dickinson. They made a big impact, as they did across the colonies. It's been said that, except for common sense, there was probably no one set of publications that had a greater impact, arguing for non-importation and passive resistance, if you will, to these British acts. So Arthur is responding to that, and a central theme for Monitor was the importance of unity of action and resistance among the colonies in the face of what Lee portrayed as an undeniable British ministerial conspiracy to rule arbitrarily. He and Richard Henry, that was a common theme of theirs in trying to bring together the colonies to act in unison as opposed to being 13 separate entities. And a few decades prior to the Declaration of Independence, I think very few people could have ever foreseen that the British American colonies would ever be able to pull together and act with a kind of harmony. Harmony may be stretching it a tiny bit, but enough harmony to form the kind of compact that they did. He also argued that the only means of ensuring the protection of threatened liberties was the creation through Parliament of a Bill of Rights for the King's American subjects. I'd like to know how really seriously they thought this was going to happen, or to what degree it was a statement that really there was no anticipation that Parliament would indeed provide a Bill of Rights for the King's British subjects. But nonetheless, that was a part of his argument. And while it's generally agreed that Arthur's essays were not up to the standards of Dickinson's, they nonetheless were widely published and served as a point of departure for an almost endless stream of writings that was to follow. But that was to happen across the Atlantic, as in September 1768, Arthur Lee, joined by his brother William, returned to London. So once again, he's back in Great Britain, where he resided for much of the next 8 years. While William commenced mercantile activities and ultimately went on to be elected a London alderman and become one of the city's two sheriffs,
Arthur initially practiced medicine, so he did get back initially to the practice of medicine and keeping. He did have some income sources coming from Virginia, but he needed the money. But he soon turned to the study of law at the ends of court, entering on March 1st, 1770, Lincoln's Inn, and then shifting in November of 1773 to Middle Temple. And he was ultimately called to the bar, so now he has abandoned medicine completely on May 5th, 1775. Well, law was a natural choice for a man of his personality and with his political bent, as you might imagine. One contemporary wrote of Arthur Lee that, quote, he delights in the fire and fury of party. And in particular, Lee believed that in London and in radical London politics lay the greatest hope for the American cause to be found in the mother country. In actuality, even before he returned to England, Lee was developing schemes to unite the cause of the famous John Wilkes, a leading thorn, if ever there was one, actually, in the side of the British ministry with that of the colonies. Indeed, by the summer of 1768, Lee had decided to return to England to, quote, defend the American cause and popularize the patriot's position. Before the close of 1768, he had indeed befriended Wilkes, who at various times was a newspaper publisher, mayor of London, member of the House of Commons, inmate in London jails, and the darling of the London and Middlesex electorate. And also very popular. He was quite the ladies' man, and also a debtor into the thousands of pounds. Time really doesn't allow for full discussion of the role of Wilkes and of London politics in this phase of British history. It's important to recall, however, that as an independent corporation, the city of London zealously guarded its rights and privileges. And there are various parallels between the cause of the American colonies and, to be anachronistic in my terminology, that of the left-leaning English metropolis. And it still is. I mean, it reminds me in a sense of Washington, D.C. and New York City. It stands, whatever the British mainstream is, London is somewhat cantankerous. The British principal locus of action for Lee and the Wilkites, as they were known, the pro-Wilkes forces, was an organization known as the Society for the Supporters of the Bill of Rights, a name later changed to the Society of the Bill of Rights. Of course, we're talking about the English Bill of Rights, but by extrapolation, you can go on. It was an appropriate organization for one who had sought an American Bill of Rights in his early Monitor letters. And while the Society existed as a power base for Wilkes and to support radical candidates and causes in England, Lee also used his position within the organization to get support for, quote, the redress of American grievances, as he was described the situation to Richard Henry in a June 11, 1771 letter. And writing to Samuel Adams on June 14th, he described his efforts with the Society of the Bill of Rights as, quote, the best effort to unite the cause of America with that of this country. So I mean, he was working within London. And it's been said that to the degree there was a party organization within Great Britain that paralleled party development in the 19th century, or presaged or pre-envisioned, if you will, the 19th century political structure in England, the society, the Bill of Rights Society developed into that kind of organization. Unfortunately, did not have a tremendous amount of influence, but they were there, and they continued to be that thorn in the side of both the ministry and George III. It was also during this period, which ended with his departure for France in late 1776, that Lee was to earn the title sometimes accorded to him, this penman of the American Revolution. Taking up where he left off as monitor in Virginia, he began to write pamphlets and contribute articles for leading London periodicals that supported the American cause under pseudonyms such as Junius Americanus and Raleigh, writing essays that ultimately found their way, in most cases, into colonial publications. Arthur was indeed the man on the scene who kept his fellow Americans up to date on the latest developments involving the decisions of King and Parliament and warning them of looming dangers. His invective could be sharp in the extreme, leading one commentator to note that Lee's pen was, quote, dipped in the gall of asps. I've always loved that one. I guess there are people today who write with pens dipped in the gall of asps, but he certainly did it. But his London life was not exclusively spent in the whirl of pre-revolutionary turmoil. I guess this is why I particularly like him. This most cosmopolitan of Lee's experienced many pleasures in the metropolis as well. He later described the period wistfully, noting, "I was placed in the chambers in the temple, which looked into a delightful little garden on the Thames, of which I had the key. I could go in and out at almost all hours and have what company I pleased without being questioned or overlooked." I don't know what that means, but I think I do know what it means, actually. "I was near the Royal Society, of which I was a fellow, where every week whatever was new and ingenious in literature was communicated. Not far from me was the hall of the Society of Arts and Agriculture, of which I was an honorary member, and where I had access to all the new discoveries in arts, agricultural, and mechanics. The playhouses and the opera were equally convenient, where I could select the opportunity of seeing the best tragedies and comedies and hearing the most exquisite Italian music. I was a subscriber to Bach's and Abel's concerts," and that was Johann Christian Bach and Carl Friedrich Abel, who set up a series of concerts in London at that time, "where the most masterly performances in the world played to a most polite and fashionable audience, in one of the most elegant concert rooms in the world. In the field of politics, from the politician in the cider cellar to the peer in his palace, I had access and influence." Now, I suppose some of you, maybe most of you, know where the Inns of Court are located, and you know it's not terribly far from Covent Garden. And I would love to live there today. I mean, it'd probably take about an income of about $10 million a year to be able to do that, given prices in London now. But it's just a wonderful place. And it's still a place of the arts, a place of opera and music and museums. And it you read this and you think, why would he want to be involved in any sort of revolution connected with this place? But nonetheless, that was the direction in which he was headed, and he had to abandon it all. But, as I say, it's one of the reasons why I'm fascinated by him. Well, I begin with the words of Benjamin Franklin, and it's time now to return to the Franklin-Lee relationship. During this period of Arthur's life, and indeed for the remainder of his days, and on to this moment, his story was and is closely linked to that of Benjamin Franklin, the man who had sponsored his membership in the Royal Society. Unfortunately, however, Franklin was to become more antagonist than scientific colleague as the years moved on, as evidenced by my beginning quote. "A factor leading to the split came when Franklin was named London agent for the Massachusetts House of Representatives in October 1770. The colonies had agents in London, as you probably know, and sometimes several agents, to try to represent their interests in a number of different ways before Parliament and the British ministry. It was a position that, again, Lee had really wanted, and I think he felt quite unhappy about not getting. He was named substitute agent to serve in the event of Franklin's absence, however. But one truly important outcome of this linkage to the Bay State was the beginning of a correspondence, and I've already mentioned one example of it, between Lee and Samuel Adams, and it was correspondence highly revealing not only about the personalities and political positions of these patriot leaders, but also about developments in Anglo-colonial relations that were inexorably moving from peaceful, though oftentimes strident, dialogue to violent confrontation. It was also revealing of the origins of the Lee-Adams connection, the Lee-Adams junto, that was, in its opposition to more conservative elements, to play a central role in the coming sessions of the Continental Congress leading to the Declaration of Independence. Because, remember, Richard Henry Lee is on this side of the Atlantic, paralleling in some respects, in many respects, what Arthur Lee was favoring in London, and they were, in very frequent communication. Despite the Arthur Lee-Ben Franklin split, however, there was one moment when Arthur Lee stood by the side of his aging fellow American. Lee now wrote as, quote, Bostonian, in the aftermath of Franklin's January 1774 Privy Council hearing and excoriation by Solicitor General Alexander Wedderburn
And what was the final act in the drama of the famous Hutchinson letters, isn't it? Those letters from Governor Hutchinson, dated in the late 1760s, they'd been purloined and published, and Franklin seems to have had a hand in that, but he had not supported their publication. Those letters basically favored abridgment of British liberties in America. I mean, it seemed to be clear what the thinking was on the part of British officials from these letters. And a stir, indeed, was created. Well, the Massachusetts legislature demanded a hearing before the Privy Council and the removal of Hutchinson. And again, I'd really like the chance to study this a bit more. If they were serious in believing that they would achieve that, I would like to know that. And I assume there are people who have studied it. It's hard for me to believe that they were serious in thinking that they could achieve the removal of Hutchinson by going before the Privy Council, and it certainly didn't happen. Instead, the governor was exonerated, and Franklin had scorn heaped upon him. It was one of the, really, I think, the worst moments of his life. And it's said really to have turned Franklin from being, even up to that point, he was something of an accommodationist. Franklin was a compromiser. He believed in finding a middle way. And he was not nearly as radical before this point. I mean, I don't know if he ever was truly radical, but he certainly was not in the Lee camp by any stretch of the imagination. But this confrontation that he had in early 1774 and the fiery coals that were placed or dropped on his head had a very strong impact on him in his direction subsequently. As noted by historian Alvin Riggs, Arthur Lee used some of his angriest invective he ever penned in coming to the defense of the humiliated Franklin. Taking aim at the Solicitor General in essays that soon reached America, he wrote, quote, "Is it the act of a coward to insult an old man? Is it the act of a villain to accuse falsely and to stab the character of an innocent man? Mr. Wedderburn is the man who insults age. Mr. Wedderburn is the man who stabs innocence." And much more. Well, anger over the treatment of the venerated Franklin rippled across the colonies, and it was yet one more development that was leading towards the ultimate break. Transforming himself from a man of letters to a man of action, Lee's final period in London was marked by challenges and risks that could have led to imprisonment or worse. By early 1775, continuing anti-American developments in Parliament had led him to relinquish hopes for peaceful settlement. And I think his hopes even then were pretty limited. And from that time on, frequent letters to Richard Henry Lee and other patriot leaders provided invaluable information on developments in Parliament and, more to the immediate point, about movement of British troops. By year's end, moreover, he'd become a paid agent of the Continental Congress. He was, in effect, a spy. Of even more lasting impact, as early as late 1774, he had also developed a line of communication with agents from France, conducting meetings which laid the foundation of the Franco-American attachment. Now, he was talking about his little garden and his chambers, the inns of court, and how he was free to have anybody he wanted to, and that's indeed one of the places that they would meet. Another place, and actually where he started to establish some of his contacts, was in no other location than Mansion House, the residence of the Lord Mayor of London, who was John Wilkes. See, another point that I find fascinating is this coming and going of these people at this particular time, again, in some of the locations in which they were meeting. Not that the British authorities were unaware of this. They were watching it very closely. And sometimes, again, I'm amazed that Lee did not find himself in irons. It was the most interesting of his connections, though, and the one that had the biggest impact, was none other than Pierre Caron de Beaumarchais, best known as the author of The Marriage of Figaro and The Barber of Seville, not Mozart's, but the plays that preceded that. Meeting at Mansion House, the residence of, as I say, Lord Mayor, and Lee's chambers in the court, the two sought ways to join the power of France to the cause of the struggling colonies. Reports of their meetings went immediately to the French minister, Vergennes, ultimately resulting in a secret grant to Beaumarchais in early June 1776 of 1 million livres to support the American cause, as well as the promise of arms and ammunition. So he really had the earliest contact with the French. Now, I will say, several years before, in a letter to Richard Henry Lee, Arthur was already predicting that the salvation for the American colonies would come from continental Europe, and in particular from France, which when you're talking about continental European power at that time of the 18th century, well, to the end of the 18th century and beyond, you are talking about France. And of course, we know what had happened between England and France, culminating in the end of the Seven Years' War in 1763. The French were eager to get back at the British. Almost unbelievable, in my opinion, if you view it back over the span of two centuries, Arthur Lee continued to practice law in England throughout this period. I mean, this is after the Declaration of Independence, and he's still practicing law. But his destiny now lay across the Channel. In December 1776, Congress commissioned Lee as a minister to the court of Louis XVI, and you probably know this. So, bundling up his possessions and leaving this wonderful place near the Thames at the ends of court and all of his playhouses and haunts there in London, he went to Paris. There he joined Silas Deane and Benjamin Franklin in an endeavor that ultimately would lead to a formal French alliance, without which victory over the British could almost surely never have been gained. He also became commissioner to Spain, from which by early 1777 he was to obtain a substantial amount of secret aid for the American forces. Sadly, these were endeavors that, again, some of you probably know, most of you probably know, fueled bitter hatreds and animosities that ultimately reached the floors of Congress and led to the recall of Silas Deane and ultimately to Lee's resignation and to sentiments as those, such as those expressed by Franklin in his never-mailed sick mind letter. Never one to find mixing public service and private gain incompatible, Silas Deane engaged in practices which the less basely motivated Arthur Lee found unpatriotic at best and in his eyes mostly criminal, and about which he could not look the other way. Ever the compromiser and also the Parisian bon vivant with his fur hat, Benjamin Franklin tried unsuccessfully both to look the other way and to rise above the fray as he worked both the French officials and the population at large. Unfortunately, Lee's puritanical devotion to the American cause and obvious distaste for the French way of conducting official business, well, not just French's, everybody's way, but they were masters at it, which typically bore far more in common with Silas Deane's point of view than with Lee's, led him into the position of being a virtual outcast in Paris. Left with time to brood and seethe, Lee now produced a stream of letters condemning his fellow ministers for their base, pandering, self-serving behavior. But, as I mentioned to begin with, this is a story for another time, or better yet, for you to explore on your own. As I noted earlier, Deane was recalled in late 1777, though the principal cause was the turmoil he created by willy-nilly granting commissions to French soldiers of fortune. It was one of those things that, as Frank knows, I think almost drove George Washington and others to total distraction. These French officers popping up right and left and demanding their units to command on the basis of these commissions that they had received from Silas Deane. In attempting to clear his name upon his return to America, Deane lashed out viciously against Arthur Lee, accusing him, among other things, of being anti-French and pro-British. And while he was... I mean, he did not really like to play the French game, and also his association with the Earl of Shelburne. He continued to write, he continued to be friends, and was looked on by the French as not a very good sign, and they did think that he was pro-British for a variety of reasons, which is a rather hard thing to understand for us today. But he did, the ongoing wrangle over this led to Franklin's being named sole minister to France, though Lee's friend John Adams had already been sent to replace Deane. Arthur retained his title of minister to Spain, but this he finally resigned when he was replaced by John Jay. Landing in Boston in August 1780, Lee received a
hero's welcome from his patriot friends, and Boston was really his power base in America, receiving not only a grant of 6,000 acres in Maine, but also an honorary degree from Harvard. Now, I'll close now by noting that Arthur Lee went on to serve terms in the Virginia legislature and the U.S. Congress, and he was also named to the Treasury Board serving in New York until the early 1790s. Unfortunately, though, the Dean affair plagued him for the remainder of his life. But the never married Lee did find joy with his nieces and nephews and peace in Middlesex County property he purchased in 1791, in which he named Lansdowne, as I mentioned earlier, as a perpetual reminder of his friendship with the Earl of Shelburne. Here he died on December 12, 1792. He really got interested in farming. I think he had been, in a way, interested earlier on in his life because of his connection to the Virginia plantation world. But he developed an interest in the hands-on aspect, and he basically took a chill, as so often was the case, and didn't survive it and died in December. And he's buried near the house. There's not a marker there. I was just recently, because there, the house Lansdowne still stands in Urbana. Some of you may have seen it. Some of you may have actually been there. It's being restored now by a couple who are really putting their hearts and souls into this property, and it takes hearts and souls and even more to make that happen, but more power to them, because it is a very significant house. Except for his closing moments at Lansdowne, though, it's difficult to say that Lee's life ever again brought him satisfaction or the recognition and status and urbane pleasure, lest we forget, he achieved during the London years. Indeed, the tumultuous period following the move to France left scars that never healed. Yet there was surely satisfaction to be taken from numerous achievements, including his early successes while still in London and winning French support, and subsequently in convincing Spanish agents to provide aid as well. Perhaps above all, though, Arthur Lee is to be credited for his massive outpouring of essays in support of the American cause. Alvin Riggs argues that, quote, he was probably the most influential publicist anywhere in the cause of the colonies. As well, it should be recalled that his writings chiefly appeared first in the London press before being widely disseminated across the future United States. Again, to quote Riggs, many Englishmen embraced the principle of no taxation without representation with a fervor hard to find outside of Samuel Adams' Boston. It seems no stretch to argue that by helping to create this third column, if you will, in England, Lee also helped to weaken British support for a war across the Atlantic. And, as he wrote Sam Adams in 1771, his efforts with the Society of the Bill of Rights ultimately did prove to be the, quote, best effort to unite the cause of America within this country. And interesting, I'm just listening to a series of tapes on the CDs on the British Empire right now. And to complement this point of view, the Neil Ferguson, the author, his principal point isn't no secret, that it ultimately was the lack of support in Britain, and particularly in England and in London, for the American War, that was to bring about the end of the conflict. And this cites a number of individuals in their statements in Parliament in opposition to the war and in support of the American cause, including Charles James Fox, and wearing the buff and blue colors into Parliament. Lastly, I don't know if you noticed or not, but my title was Arthur Lee, Enlightened, quote-unquote, patriot. Now, why have I used enlightened in quotes to title this talk? Webster defines enlightened as, quote, freed from ignorance and misinformation. And this, of course, implies that the unenlightened are those ignorant and misinformed. While I'm not sure that the term holier-than-thou was in use during the 18th century, it probably was, I fear that it characterizes much of Arthur Lee's approach to life. Though beyond doubt a brilliant man and a devoted patriot, the perhaps unfortunate fact is that his legacy might loom much larger today had he borrowed just a bit of Franklin's ability to compromise or Dean's talents at doing business the French way. I'll leave that for you, being part of John Adams' posterity, to decide. Thank you very much. Well, surely. I just hope that I might be able to answer them.
Please repeat the question.
I surely will. If anybody would like to know about geothermal HVAC systems as well, I'd be more than happy to speak on that. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Well, I think his money trouble was a relative thing. I don't think he was ever wealthy, but he did have holdings. He did have holdings in the Northern Neck. I mean, he had made some money. He was never. Although I must say, I do sometimes find this a fascinating point. And some of these individuals who claim, on the one hand, to just be the wolf is at the door, and yet somehow they keep on going. And so I think that it's a combination of factors. Some of the income that he was able to make himself in practicing law, some of the income from his holdings in the Northern Neck. I think when he died, he did not sell the acreage in Maine, but he did leave that. I have a copy of his will with me, as a matter of fact. So I think there are a combination of sources that enabled him to buy that property. Have you ever been there to Lansdowne? Yeah, have you been in the house? Yeah, it's a remarkable house. It has had some modifications to it, and it has suffered from some pretty bad termite infestation, which I think has been resolved now. But the people who own it really are to be commended, and I was there with the Northern Neck AAPVA group back in the fall, and early fall, and they seem to be pretty good about welcoming at least groups like that. So if you're interested in bringing someone there, it could possibly be set up. But it's when you think about the surviving Lee properties, Stratford's one that always stands out, but Chantilly being gone and Monocan a ruin, as interesting as it is, it's fortunate that Lansdowne is still there in a reasonably good shape and a beautiful house with wonderful detailing outside and in. So again, if the opportunity ever arises, I would suggest you go there and go back there. In the graveyard area, unfortunately, there was a major storm that took down some trees, but there's a marker there, but it's not actually one that is from the period of Arthur Lee. How many of you have been to the Inns of Court area? Inns of Court? How many of you have been to the Inns of Court? And the Covent Garden, you've probably been to Covent Garden. It's just, as I say, if I had that big income you need to live in London, I believe I'd be there right now. It's a wonderful, wonderful place. So when I read his description of that, the life he was leading. But then on the other hand, I live in Fredericksburg, and it's got some values too, as a merit. But once more, there are sources out there, and then most of you, of course, probably have access to the internet. And if you Google Arthur Lee, there's also a British rock singer named Arthur Lee. So you need to work your way through that. But there are a lot of references to Arthur Lee. And all that's getting better and better. There's a Wikipedia entry for Arthur Lee that I think is mostly correct, with some links to other Arthur Lee sites. Again, he's not unknown, but as Frank alluded to begin with, he's. I think that his role, as I would like to point out, is one that, nonetheless, despite the various publications that have come out, is still somewhat under-recognized as far as his contribution to the American cause. So, yes, sir, I believe you said.
Did he ever marry?
He never married. And the question was, did he ever marry? No, he never married. Apparently, when he was in France, he had some lady friends. I'm not sure about in England. I mean, he was not opposed to spending time with the opposite sex, but he never seems to have had a serious relationship, one that came in any way close to marriage. So he was the only one of that generation who did not marry. And again, it may get back to that personality. I'm just not sure. It could be that after a few days in the company of Arthur Lee, they decided that there were better pickings elsewhere. At Lansdowne. But it does seem to be, again, aside from those years in London
And what the happiness quotient is. I mean, was he on a scale of 1 to 10, was he a 7 part of the time in London and an 8 part of the time? I don't know, but it does seem to have been a good time for him and by and large. But I don't know that he ever really attained what's that level of satisfaction with his life. Certainly not after he left London, certainly not in France, until this short period at Lansdowne. And as I say, he did spend a fair amount of time with his nieces and nephews. He visited, these are Shippen nieces and nephews, he visited Stratford with them and traveled with them in other places in Maryland and Virginia. And he certainly enjoyed their company as well. But it was that time at Lansdowne that seems to have been his happiest moments. Well, I certainly want to thank you all for being here. I have to add just one point. For reasons that I cannot understand, my wife and several other people have said that they think I should be a priest. I am an Episcopalian. I'm not a terribly good one these days, but I am an Episcopalian. And I really do. I don't know exactly where they're coming from. But I don't know that I'll ever make it. At least this has provided me with an opportunity to be in the pulpit, and I do thank you for that and for listening to and to me talk about Arthur Lee. Thank you very much. And come to see us at Stratford.